That emotional sobriety pamphlet I gave you. It's an article Bill wrote, and the title of it says he wrote to a fellow depressive. Depression isn't new, especially for addicted people. I was termed manic depressive and that I could never live without some sort of medication. I haven't had a good one, in 25 years. And I used to get the good ones. I used to get the ones where covers over the head and you wouldn't see me for days and I'd try to starve myself or I'd just wish I'd die. And it wasn't a casual thought. But true faith does overcome it. But the 12 steps are the way to build the faith. But if you don't do the directions, you can't have the faith. See, that's one of the things I love about the 12 steps. And I have a lot of pastors come to me and talk with me about when I took this big, I was pointed to this big church and this guy really worked to get me there. And he came in, I was there the second day, and he said, Ed, he said, I'm so delighted to have you here with church with us. He said, I've been in the ministry for 30 years, and I know all the ins and outs of the Methodist system, and I'm so glad you're here. He said, I've got one favor to ask you. And I said, what's that? He said, teach me about God. And it was one of the most humbling moments in my life. And I said, well, there's only one way I can really teach you about that. You need to go through the 12 steps with me. He said, I'll do whatever it takes because I'm lost. And I said, well, I want you to call me every night. Tell me how your day. This is my boss. I want you to call me every night. Check in with me. See how you're doing so we can have at least a conversation. We're going to go through the steps. When we get to steps 4 and 5, you're going to take it with me, my boss. In that process, he had been on Prozac for 30 years. I said, why are you on it? He said, well, I don't remember. I said, well, let's just call your psychiatrist and see if maybe we can do something here. He called up. His psychiatrist had been retired for 5 years. They just kept reprocessing the prescription. So I said, let's get you to a new doctor and let's see about slowly taking you off that. Now, this is not an alcoholic guy. This is just a guy, one of those guys that, his problem was a Prozac deficiency, so they give him Prozac. And anybody who gets off medication should never, ever do it on their own. I did it. That's the exact wrong way. You can die. You can die, and it's not something to mess with. It's can be very complicated and very dangerous. But as we went through the steps, he did his 4th and 5th with me. He went and made his amends to his father. And this guy, when he used to preach, I'd snore. Well, you know, Prozac is all monotone. And he didn't have any fire going anyway. So, and after he went through the 12 steps, he wrote me one of the nicest references I've ever been given. And in that, he says, Ed taught me how to find God again through the 12 steps. And I'm forever grateful to him. You know, this thing works if we're willing to apply it to every area of our life. We'll do one more question, then we'll do lunch. I know you guys are hungry. Great question. How do you know within yourself that you have started the surrender? You know immediately. You know immediately. For me, my stomach loosened up a little bit. My grip on life loosened up a little bit. My emotional stranglehold on life loosened up a little bit. That's when I know I'm starting to surrender. And just like anything else, we practice these steps. We practice them, and the more we practice them, the better we get. The less we practice them, the worse we get. That's why people leave AA and say, I've been through the steps, they don't work. Wrong. They work wonderfully, but only if you keep practicing them. The more you practice surrender, it's like deep breathing. You know, I can sit there and think about taking a deep breath, and before I even take the breath, now I'm relaxed. It's the same thing about surrender. Difficult at first because I got to get rid of all those little fish hooks in it. But when I really decide fish hooks and all, it's no problem at all. And that's the greatest feeling I've ever had, where I don't have to go through any process to surrender, just simply surrender. And you'll know when you can. I think that's enough for right now. Oh, yeah. I know it's time for lunch. Joyce, is there anything we need to do? Am I reading this right? Is she already out there? Yeah, because a lot of you have sent questions up, I want to spend a few minutes and just take some time and answer some of them, okay? One of which was laying right on top here. It said, there's a lot of controversy about the Lord's Prayer being said at meetings. Please comment. I have no understanding why anybody'd have a problem with that prayer. If you call it religious, then take out half the book that's taken from the book of James. Whoever's putting out this nonsense has no idea the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. If it was not for a holiness movement, you wouldn't be here. And it says in our book that we are to lay aside prejudice, even against organized religion. The very fact that people want this prayer out is what we stand against. You know? I talked at a bunch of places for a while there where instead of the Lord's Prayer, the Serenity Prayer, they would say the responsibility statement. And I was kind. And there happened to be a member of from General Service Office speaking with me. And I said, did you notice? She said, yeah, that's the way to do that. She said, we don't want to upset anybody. I said, well, you failed there. I'm annoyed. She said, well, we just don't want to offend anybody. I said, do you understand that you just took the 11th step out of meetings? Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him. How dare you? Who gives you that right? And you know the way I say the Lord's Prayer? Same way I said it last night. For those who care to, join me in the Lord's Prayer or pray to the God of your own understanding. You got to really work to be offended at that. That's as inclusive as you can get. And if that drives you out of meetings, I got a feeling God will drive you right back in or you aren't going to get it at all. But for a few people, here's the bottom line on that as far as I'm concerned. People are trying to make AA secular. It's not. Read the basic text. It's a spiritual way of life. They say it's a religious prayer. Religious means regular. Regular practice of spiritual principles. Yeah, it's a religious prayer. And you come to AA religiously. So what's the problem? And I think we got to pay more attention to that, and we really got to pay attention to people who are trying to drive God out of meetings, because I hate to tell you, they're having tremendous success. I spoke at a place in a place I won't mention, in a state I won't mention, Indiana, and five people got up, and it was a birthday. They were having birthdays at this anniversary. Five birthdays from 1 to 24 years. Everybody got up, and nobody thanked God. Not once. They thanked their committee and their group and their position and their sponsor. And, of course, the guy with 24 years had his suit and tie on and was taking pot shots at the other birthday takers. And, you know, nobody thanked God. And I got up and I said, I don't mean any offense here, but did you notice nobody thanked God during their birthday talk? And I said, if you listen to some of them, you'd have the idea God is their own reflection. Yeah. And that guy wouldn't talk to me after the meeting. That's fine. He wants to put it out there. I'll inventory it. You know, just as you're more than welcome to inventory anything I share with you and talk to me about it. Because that's how we grow. That's how we grow. But I go into a lot of meetings where God's never mentioned. That just amazes me. And it's becoming more rather than less. So that's that. How do we start to trust in our alcoholic again when there's... associated with... I'm sorry, I can't read the writing. And they are still drinking? I got that part. Don't trust him anywhere if he's still drinking. Why would you trust him at all if he's still drinking? You know, that's like hanging out with a cannibal and going to supper with him when they say, no, I'm quitting. No, thanks. I'd just as soon pass, you know. Where do you start when it comes to forgiving someone who doesn't admit or accept or acknowledge that they violated you? Well, we're going to be talking about 8 and 9, and I got some news for you. It ain't about you. It's about what you did to them, and you're repairing the damage you did to them. Isn't that amazing? More and more I understand the steps 8 and 9 have little to do with me. It ain't about me. If I'm looking to get something out of it, I missed the steps. Because the steps, to the way I understand it, is to repair the damage I've done. And why are you forgiving somebody who don't accept, admit, you know, what's that got to do with anything? What's your part in it? Do you think I went up to the guy in prison and that murdered my father and said, now, there's a little test here. Do you regret what you did? You're going to make amends to me for killing my dad? No. If I'm forgiving, that's the business I'm in. Forgiving. If I'm in forgiving, that's what I am. I'm not. It's like love. Don't love me if it's conditional. If you can't love me unconditional, then you love me far away, would you? Relationships are a funny thing. In AA, you know, if you sponsor people, you all have an uh-huh machine because you need one, especially when they find him or her. Just put him on the uh-huh machine. Oh, he's beautiful. Uh-huh, uh-huh. He's like nobody I've ever met. Uh-huh, uh-huh. Just a dream come true. Uh-huh, uh-huh. In about 5 minutes, pick up the phone and say, how's that? Oh, great, thanks for listening. You know, no, I'm just kidding. But that's really close to what it is. My job is to be honest with where I'm at. When I got into the ministry, I put my standards higher than they'd ever been. I realized, and I put it really on the same level as being a speaker in AA, I like to be above reproach. There has never been a time when I put that in jeopardy that I know of, because it's that important to me. And when I got into the ministry, I said to God, I said, you know, God, if there's somebody you want to be in my life, you got to hit me with a 2x4, because I ain't going anywhere near it, you know, because I like ladies. I always have. And I've surrendered that. And I was out in Oklahoma talking, and this gal come up to me afterwards, beautiful woman. I've known her for a couple of years. And she said, Ed, can I talk to you? And I said, why, sure. And she said, you know, I have always been terribly attracted to you. And I said, oh, thank you. Just say thank you. Thank you. And she said, I hope that doesn't offend you. And I said, why, no, not at all. Thank you very much. Inside of me, thank you, Jesus. Thank you. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you. Amen, Jesus. Thank you. Thank you. But outside, I'm going, why, thank you. That's very kind. That's very kind. And she's a delightful person, and we spent some time together, and we spent a lot of time talking. And then all of a sudden, our relationship was based on how she was feeling about what I was doing. And I said, see ya, because I don't do crazy anymore. It's a choice. I don't do crazy anymore. I can't afford to do crazy anymore. Life's too short to do crazy. And you may wonder what that has to do with forgiving someone who doesn't even admit or acknowledge. I have no idea. It's what came to mind. Somebody out there needed to hear that. The book speaks of a spiritual malady. I believe somehow as a child something may have broke in me spiritually. Long before I drank, I felt different. What could possibly cause a spiritual breakdown in a child at a very young age? Well, probably same thing that could a child of a very old age. You know, life happens, and spiritual malady, do you know what that actually means, spiritual malady? means spiritual disease. That's the definition, spiritual disease. So if it broke when you were younger, that's just when your spiritual disease started. And that's when it's got a hold of you. And it can end anytime you apply these steps. These steps are a direct antidote for a spiritual malady. So I would suggest to you, instead of trying to figure out why it was when you were a child at a very early age, why don't you just apply it now? Because it really doesn't matter either way if it was when you were a kid, I would think. How do you surrender? Tears, pain, depression, anger toward inward. Yeah, the aggression. Depression is anger toward inward. I wouldn't argue with that at all. And how do you surrender? You just simply do it. I mean, think about it. It's like us standing over a stove with our hands in the fire saying, now how do I take my hand out of the fire? Like this. How do you take that thought out of your mind? Like this. And we already talked about it. Replace it with something that's healing. How do you surrender? Is you immediately lift it up and do something else. Replace a negative thought with a good thought. Replace an unspiritual thought with a spiritual thought. Replace a depressing thought with an uplifting thought. Do you know, this is a fact, do you know that if you smile, it releases serotonin into your system? Guess what every antidepressant has in it? Main ingredient, for the most part, is serotonin. When you smile, just a smile, don't even have to be a sincere one. Hi, how are you? Fine, how are you? It releases serotonin into your system. More than that, if you simply think a good thought, it has now been discovered that that releases serotonin into your system. Now, if you're sitting around thinking how life sucks every day, guess why you're depressed? No serotonin there. No serotonin there. All right, we'll do two more. Well, it's kind of, I have done several four steps, and it seems like that I am just getting some stuff from my childhood. Why is this just coming up now? You know, that's where I get into a problem with all the psychoanalytical stuff that's happening anymore. And those Freudian complexities. Who cares? Why does it make a difference? It was your child. It's like people talk to me, I've hated my father for 30 years. Why? What payoff is that? Because there's got to be some payoff or you'd stop doing it. None of us are dummies in here. We got to be getting something out of it or we wouldn't be putting into it. Maybe it's filling my victim of the day, you know. But whatever it is, you know, why are you doing it? Explain sober if I've never been intoxicated. If you're breathing, I find that hard to believe. You've never been intoxicated by a love song or a movie or a starlit night. If you're human, I find that hard to believe. I find that very hard to believe. You've never met somebody or did something, oh, that'd make all the difference in the world. And then you got them and you realize, nope, that's not it either. Sober to me, it's really an excellent question because I really believe that first I have to be chemically free. That's for me. I believe that from my head to my toes. I got to be chemically free because I abused everything under the sun. I don't have any pros and cons about that. I just know for me that is impossible. The surrender is at that depth, and that's the way I like it. So sober is without chemicals. There's one, but I think. And I hear people say, if I felt that bad, I'd go get drunk. No, no, thank you, because a bad day sober is better than a bad day drunk. It absolutely is. Just hang in here. And sober to me means to be able to look the world in the eye as it is. And the intellectual part is to function capably and efficiently. And the spiritual ramification for that is for me to function faithfully. Sober for me today is functioning faithfully. There is not a day go by that something doesn't reduce me to tears. During the day go by. That's part of being sober for me. Because I always denied feelings. I always denied how I felt. I always thought caring about people was a sign of weakness. And now I realize it's my greatest strength. But I'll see something on TV. Somebody will say something kind to me. I'll see a little girl and their father having a constructive day, smiling and giggling. I'll see new people come into AA, and people have been around for a while coming in here with death written all over their face, and all of a sudden the light comes on. And you know something's changing. That's sober to me today, being fully present. Being fully present and able to walk through whatever God gives me to walk through. And I don't mean God gives me everything, because I believe there's a lower power as well as a higher power. And I believe the less you talk about the lower power, the more power he has. And so I really believe that anything good in my life is what God gives me. And anything bad that comes into my life, God will bring something good if I just wait. If I just wait long enough. So being sober is being fully present, aware of God and his power, and me and my lack of power. That's sober to me. One more. There is no question. Okay. Ooh, small print. How does a parent encourage their children to seek recovery when they ask for help or guidance with living alcoholic? I'm not sure I understand. Dan, the question, I'm not sure it's as simple as, if it's this simple, you simply get them some help. How does a parent help? Usually, you take them to somebody else that can help them. It's like helping your brother get sober, not a good idea. I remember when my brother came to me and said, I want to get sober, I took him up to the meeting and I said, go through that door and ask for Big John. See you later. Why? Because I want the best for him. I don't want me being part of the sickness, being part of his recovery. So what I would suggest to you is you take your children to an Al-Anon or an Alateen group, or depending on where they're at, whether they're the ones that are experiencing the rebuff of alcoholism and addiction, or they're the ones experiencing it. I would highly recommend that, because there's a lot of people around, and there's a lot of good Alateen members. How's Alateen here in Ohio? Is it moving? Good. I think that's one of the most underinvested programs we've got. And boy, it's a wonderful thing, because I've seen a lot of hope come out of them, and I've seen a lot of good members of Al-Anon and AA come from those rooms. So thank you, God, for Alateen, you know. But that's what I do. Okay, one more. You talked me into it. Why do I/we hear that in one respect this is a selfish program? Because you can't give it away what you don't have. Isn't it written in one of our books? Well, you could pretty much parse anything you want out of one of our books. And what I think they're meaning when they say selfish, I think the original intent was your program's got to come first, is what I think they meant. But that isn't necessarily a selfish act, because especially if you're married, it's going to fit the family too. And if you make it all about you, it's always going to be all about you. And because you can't give it away if you don't have it, well, I don't know why, but what came to mind when I was about 3-4 weeks sober, everybody was being nice to me, and I nudged this guy next to me. I said, what do these people want from me? He said, what do you got that anybody'd want, you know? What I mean by that is that I need to come here and be fed. I need to come here and learn how to be what I've not been able to be. And can't give it away to keep it. At that point, when I walk in the room, I've got something to give away. I'm trying to think of her name. She was the woman sober longest in L.A. for, oh boy, just went right through. Selby? Do you remember? Woman in Southern California? Anyway, Sybil. Sybil was sober longest in L.A., and she went to her first AA meeting in Los Angeles, and they said, okay, we're having the meeting now. All you women go out and knit. And Sybil got pushed outside. And she called New York crying, saying, they pushed me outside. They said, well, you got to tell them you're an alcoholic. They've never seen a woman alcoholic before. You got to go tell them you're an alcoholic. So the next week, they went to the meeting and they did the division. Sybil said, no, I'm an alcoholic. Ruth told me I could stay. So, oh, okay, come on in, stay. And it was right after the Saturday Evening Post article that a lot of public response, and they were giving everybody stacks of postcards from their area because these people had driven like some 100 miles to come to this meeting once a week. And it was the first one in Southern California. And they got to Sybil and they handed her a stack of postcards like this thick. And she said, what's this? And she said, that's from women alcoholics. Want you to go call on them. And she said, what do I tell them? I've only been to one meeting. You tell them you've been to one meeting and you want to invite them to the next. That's what you tell them. And she carried the message, you know. She carried the message. So she had something to give away. She'd been to a meeting. And that's what she gave away. And she's the longest sober woman. And, you know, I'm trying to remember. I believe Sybil's still alive. I believe she's in ill health. But she's still alive. The other thing this reminds me of is you can't love anybody else till you love yourself. Really? What a load of crap. Talk about self-serving, self-involved nonsense. I don't know about you, but I fell in love with you long before I fell in love with you. And because I fell in love with you and you saw something good in me is when I found out what the love about me. It wasn't the reverse. It isn't all about me. I'm coming here to learn to be of love and service, not love and self-service. That's the difference. All right. We'll stop there for now. We got a few more, but how are we doing on time? Good. We're doing bad. That's good. Hate organization. Least possible organization. Isn't that what they say? I'm living proof of that, by God. Step 7, humbly ask him to remove all our shortcomings. God, that was so important for me. We talked about a lot of them already, honesty and humility and true tolerance of one another and surrendering to the anger and the self-righteous indignation. You know, just giving that up and not participating in it anymore. And I think it's real important to reiterate here again, it talks about asking God to remove it. Give it to him and then keep your hands off of it. Please don't fix it. Please don't fix it, because if you're like me and I'm fixing it, it seems to get worse long before it gets better. But when I say that prayer, like, God save me from being angry, it actually works. God save me from being so judgmental, it works. God save me from lying. I know none of you ever experienced this, but I used to lie from time to time. I had a definite quirk. You always knew when I was lying because my lips would be moving. And that was a sign. That was a sign. Now, what was difficult about that is I didn't know it was a lie. Because as soon as I said it, it became true in my mind. So once I buy it, what's it to lay it on you? So one of the shortcomings I had was dishonesty or lack of honesty. And that was a tough one. And I had to start several times. I didn't understand surrender then. I was working through it, thank you very much. And sometimes I'd have to back up in a conversation like 4 times. I'd start a conversation, I'd say, oh, wait a minute, that's a lie. Hold on a minute, let me back. I'd start a conversation again, oops, no, that's a lie. Let me take me about 3 good runs to get at the truth. And people looked at me funny, but I was getting better. I was getting better. I can remember the time I had a fake ID. I'm not sure why, because I drank in bars from when I was 11 years old. I was 6'4", 6'5", at 11. And I remember when I got my draft card. Got my draft card, and I had an ID that said I was 23. And I couldn't tell you which was true. I couldn't. I was honestly confused. What's the truth? See, if you tell a lie so long, you'll get to believing it. Like, I'm so sick, nobody could help me. You don't understand. My family's always been this way. You don't understand. My mother was like this. My father was like this. All those lies. And as soon as I told them, I believed them. So in step 7, that's one of them. I had to get honest with myself. And it talks about rigorous honesty there. And it's tough from time to time. I remember there was a time in AA when I was having a tough time and people loaned me some money. When I meant to get it back to them. I wasn't stealing because I meant to get it back to them. Right? Guess what? If you don't get it back to them, it's stealing. It's stealing. And I kept thinking, oh, no, I'll get it back to him when I get the opportunity. I'll just, you know. One day the opportunity came about. I remember I called Clancy. I said, Clancy, I owe you some money, don't I? He said, well, maybe. I said, do you know how much that'll be? He said, hold on a second. $984.36. I said, oh, okay. And Clancy's always sitting in his office, and there's always 5 guys sitting around, and all 4 lines are lit up. That's just the way it is. And I said, well, I'm sending you a check. And he said to the guy sitting there, quick, in my coat, the small white pills, get me one. Now, what I loved about him is he didn't humiliate me. He accepted the money graciously, knowing that I figured it out one day at a time about honesty. When you say you're going to do something, do it. I've heard people say, well, I've never stolen a thing from anybody. Really, what about time from your family, time from your job, love and affection that should have gone this place and went that place? How big a thief are you, even today? How big a thief are you? Last April, when I went to badge my son as a Los Angeles County Sheriff, I went out there on Wednesday. He was being badged on Thursday. And I went out to Los Angeles, and I'm sitting with my daughter and my ex-wife. And they said, well, what are your plans? What are you going to do? And I said, well, you're my plans. And their mouth fell open. And they said, what do you mean? Aren't you going up to see Clancy? Aren't you going to some meetings? Aren't you going to... I said, that depends on your plans. You're my priority. And tears came to their eyes. My daughter is 21 years old, and she'd never heard those words come out of my mouth. I didn't do it intentionally. I just didn't know better. I do now. I do now. And I'm real grateful for that. You know, I stole a lot of time and give it to activities I'd prefer to do. Now, I'm not talking about serious 12-step calls. I'm not talking about things that needed to be done. But my family was the last, not the first. And I think of all the missteps I've made in AA, probably that's the one that I want the most recovery from, is to let my children know that they're the apple of my eye. And that I'd like to make up for all the times I wasn't there. You know? That's step 7. Honesty. Looking at my life honestly rather than how I see it. Looking at my, and that's not to say that you don't stay active in AA, and that's not to say AA doesn't come first. But my family needed to be a real close second to that sobriety. A lot closer than I'd ever put them. And a lot of that is by who we follow. If we're following somebody who's, committed to AA every minute of every second of every day, then somebody suffers, and it's usually the family. And that was my path. And it isn't for the guys. You know the guys I sponsor? If they're married, they have a date night every week. If they have children, they have a family night every week. Or I don't sponsor them. You know why? Family and the wife or the husband deserves more of the sobriety too. They got the full brunt of the disease. By God, they should get some of the gifts. And if you can't be around them, well, grow up and be around them. Maybe you need some learning to do and some growing up to do to be around them and accept them the way they are. If, after all, isn't that what you're screaming? You know? Why don't you accept me for who I am? Well, that goes both ways. But it was tough for me to understand that, and it was hurtful to see my daughter, because I honestly didn't realize it till that moment when she got tears in her eyes. Arrogance. Arrogance is terrible. Gossip. I was terrible on that. Got to be real careful. To this day, I got to be real careful. If it isn't good, I don't share it. And if they aren't there to defend themselves, I won't recuse it. And people don't do well with gossip with me, because Clancy helped me with that one time. I went up and I was ripping somebody. I was just ripping them big time. Character assassination, first class. I was ripping them big time. And you know what Clancy did? He waited till I was all finished and he said, "Funny, Ed, all they ever say is kind things about you." The next week, same person. I'm character assassinating. I'm not a quick study. Got all done, he listened to it, and he said, "Funny, Ed, all he ever says is kind things about you." And I got it. And I got it. There's a sarcastic sense of humor around a lot of AA, to me, that is very destructive. And I say that having been a retired expert at sarcasm. I could cut off your knees at any given time. God gave me a very good mind, and I was not using it for very good purposes. What I used to think is, oh, they just get upset because they're not as quick as I am. No, they just get upset at the arrogant ass that's talking. That's who they got upset at. And I remember one time I said, if my humor hurts somebody, tell me about it. Show me, God. And it was that night I was at a meeting, and a little gal, I don't remember her name, but I remember her eyes. They were beautiful and they were happy. And she came up and was saying something to me, and I made some sarcastic remark and laughed and turned away. And as I walked down the aisle, her eyes came to mine after I made the remark. And I saw the pain and sadness that I had caused by my remark. And I cried. I found a group of people who accepted me, the most of the unacceptable, welcomed me into their homes. And all I could do was make cute little snotty remarks and dress it up as humor. I tried my best to stop that. Wayne and I were at a conference a while back. And there was a guy laying on the rows of chairs. You know, it was set in a theater style. And he was laying out and his toes were hanging out. And I walked by and I grabbed one of his toes and I said, "You're healed." And everybody laughed and I kept walking. And somebody else was talking. I remember the guy came up to me and said, "Can I talk to you for a minute?" I said, "Sure." He said, "I'm dying of hepatitis C. I have a bad liver, and I'm not eligible for any transplants. It's very difficult for me to walk. And I'm laying down trying to get a little rest, trying to figure out if I can stay for the speaker. And some smart aleck comes by and grabs my foot and says, 'You're healed.'" Said it didn't strike me as very funny. Said, "I'm so sorry." Wayne said, "Oh, it was an innocent comment. But it was one that didn't need to be said. It just didn't need to be said." Character assassination, gossip, sarcasm. You look up the basic word from the Greek root, And sarcasm is ripping or tearing of flesh. And that's exactly what it is. And I got to watch myself to this day. I'm sitting in a restaurant Tuesday night, and I see a friend of mine I haven't seen in a long time. And he's being very gracious and kind to me, and we're talking. And somehow we get together every Tuesday night, a lot of the guys I sponsored before home group, and we're talking, and politics come up, and they said something about Chuck Norris saying that the McCain was too old. And I said, well, so's his toupee, you know. And Buddy laughed, and I looked across the table at my dear friend and his toupee. And he looked at me. I thought, boy, that wasn't necessary. That just wasn't necessary. And I ate supper knowing that I had to go over there and set this right, because I really enjoy this guy. I really like this guy. And I walked over and I said, did you hear that crappy remark I made? He said, no. Did you make a crappy remark? I said, yeah. He said, was it about me? I said, no, no, it wasn't about you. He said, no, I didn't hear anything. And I said, I'm glad. I'm pleased you didn't. And, but I don't want to forget that feeling. That feeling of how I just, a remark that's just a throwaway remark that could just hurt somebody so badly. I don't want to be remembered for that. If I want to be remembered for anything, I want to be remembered for something that lifted you, not flattened you. Lifted you. So when we talk about the seventh step and when we talk about gossip and character assassination, remember the person you may be putting down might be the person God put on this world to save the life of the person you're putting them down to. And your gossip just killed them. That's what I told you last night with Clancy. If I had heard a lot of the things that goes around about him, I would have never asked him to be my sponsor. And there again, Clancy isn't perfect by any stretch, and nobody else is. It's kind of ironic, because when you hear people put down other people, ask them a couple questions like, oh, how long have you known him? Inevitably, they'll go, oh, I don't know him, I just heard this. Inevitably. And I have a nice way of just saying, then why don't you shut up? Well, that's rude. No, what you were doing was rude. I'm just ending the rudeness. You know? We're not supposed to do that. We got to lift each other up. We feel bad enough about ourselves, most of us, until we surrender that. There's another character, self-hate. We talked a little bit about it earlier. Self-hate, denial of peace and comfort within our very own souls. Why is it that we withhold the greatest gifts God's given us? Why is it we withhold the promises from us? By not allowing us to be forgiven and to forgive. That's where that one about forgiving somebody who doesn't repent. You know, a lot of people say you forgive for yourself. I don't believe that. You forgive for the good of the world. That's what I believe. It isn't about me. And when I forgive the guy who killed my father, I had to do that because anything I don't forgive poisons every good love I have in my life. Every resentment you have towards your childhood taints your children. Every resentment you have about anything in your life, in relationships, taints your current relationships. Resentment and anger is one of the few substances that destroys the vessel that carries it. It just destroys the vessel that carries it. The reason I forgive is so I can be healed. And I need to forgive me. Now, if you're Christian and you buy that whole deal, you should be in good shape. Because every once in a while I'll have somebody come up and talk to me and they're having a tough time forgiving themselves. And I say, well, what's your faith? And they'll say, well, I'm Christian. And I say, well, do you get that whole thing about the cross stuff? And they said, well, yeah. I said, what was that for? I said, for all my sins. I said, for forgiveness, huh? And well, yeah. And I said, oh, so it was for everybody but you. I get it now. That's a little sarcasm, but it puts it to light. You're really the only one God is in. God of the universe that can change lives like that is going to hold a little grudge against you, huh? who gives you the right to hate a child of God? And I said it earlier, like it or not, you're a child of God. Who gives you, who in the hell are you to put you down and make light of you? Who gives you that right? And why would you want to keep on doing that? If you want to get better. If you want to get better. The willingness to not forgive things in my past. I used to have a list of things. I remember when I was 9, I was molested by the next door lady. And I hear a lot of people talk about those. In fact, out of the hundreds of inventories I've heard, I think there's been one that I didn't hear an instance similar to that. Well, guess what? You can make it what your life's all about and let it own you. Or you can say, me too, next. Me too, next. When I was in Job Corps, 1966, I was drugged and a gang of guys had their way with me. I was so naive, I didn't even understand what happened. I just knew that I was sore in places I'd never been sore before, and nobody had talked to me anymore. What good does it do for me to remember that? What good would it do for me to remember that day in and day out, and day in and day out? It'd taint every relationship I've ever had and have. The best thing I can do is forgive the situation. Was it right? Forgiveness does not mean approval. Forgiveness does not mean, oh, gee, glad you did that. Forgiveness is you accept it for what it was. If it was heinous and mean and full of ill intent, so be it. That's why when I was preaching about forgiveness in the church, and I'd realized I'd forgiven the guys who killed my father years ago. Now understand, right after they'd killed my father, I was familiar with county jail. And I had plotted how to an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It kept going over my mind. I sat down with a few AA members and told them how I was feeling, what I was thinking. You know what they did? They got up and walked away and said, I thought you had a good program. Unfortunately, they got drunk a few years later. I'm still here. And the reality of it was, is I had a good program because I was telling them what I was really feeling and how badly it hurt and how angry I was. And I wasn't acting on it. I was, at the best I could, surrendering it at that point for what I knew of surrender. They got up and walked away, and for a long time I thought, well, that's it. I ain't telling anybody else how I feel in AA. Until I found a sponsor I could tell everything to. And then it didn't matter anymore. But forgiveness does not mean approval. Forgiveness does not mean... But I'll also do this. If people say, well, I'll forgive, but I won't forget, I'll say, don't bother then. You're still keeping score. Oh, there's a good one. Character defect, let's keep score in relationships. Doesn't that work well? Well, you did, yeah, but remember when you did, yeah, but you did, and you did, and you did. All right. Guaranteed fight there. Giving up keeping score one day at a time. The right to judge. Giving up keeping score. What scores are you guys keeping? I'd suggest at our break you leave them here. Put them in that trash bin. And leave the score sheets here. And just live the best you can a day at a time and allow other people to do that same thing. Now you're not going to do it perfectly, but you're going to feel a whole lot better by just trying it. Step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. That means exactly what it says. We're out of time again. That means exactly what it says. I made a list of everybody from childhood on. And to be honest with you, certainly not to be braggadocious, I pretty much harmed everybody I knew in one way or the other. through my mouth or through my actions or through my physical acts or through my rants and my raves. So, you know, in this sense, my life has to be a living amend. Here's one of the ways I do it today. I was down south having a cup of coffee. I was going to, every time I go to Nashville, they take me to prison. They always say that, when you come in these city limits, you're going to prison. Well, they got a grade AA program there is what they do. And so anytime I'm there, they run me right into prison. And we got into doing it again. And we stopped to get a cup of coffee because we were a bit early. And my friend Scott ordered a cup of coffee. It was a hot day. Hot. He ordered a cup of coffee. I'm not sure why. Yeah, I do. He was drunk. He had to have coffee. And the gal that was getting his coffee was rather a big gal, and it was a hot day. And as she was walking back, Scott said to her, I want to thank you so much for coming to work today. You do a fine job. You've made my life better. And her spirit just lifted. I thought, how much did that cost? That's how you make a living amend. Try to lift the people around you. I don't know if I told you last night about my friend Jimmy. I was 2.5 years sober and very suicidal. Knew a couple things. Number one, these steps don't work for me. They may work for you, but I've tried and failed. And the magic and music is alive for you, but they certainly aren't for me. And I was going home to turn on the gas in the garage. He had a bunch of gas coffee pots and kill myself. That was my plan. And when it's that dark, you don't leave notes. You don't get dramatic. You just want out. And I stopped by the club at 26th and Broadway in Santa Monica. And I walked in there. And a guy named Jimmy Ryan was there. And Jimmy was from Texas. He was a salesman from Texas. And Jimmy was rapid-fire salesman. He always talked like this, rub his hands together like this. And he said, you know, one time I asked some psychiatrist why I rub my hands together like this. He told me, I smacked him right in the mouth. But that was Jimmy. And now remember my plan. I'm going home to turn on the gas. That's my plan. No notes, no sad goodbyes. I'm done. And my mean sponsor insisted that I shake hands and say hi to everybody. And at that time, the group was small. It was only about 400. And I said, I don't want to shake their hands. I don't like them. And he said, Ed, they don't like you either. Go shake their hand. Hi, I'm Ed. Hi, I'm Ed. I'm Ed, you know. So I walk into this, and out of habit, I walk up to Jimmy, and I say, hi, Jimmy, how are you? Now, I don't know if Jim said this to everybody, but he said it to me. It was like the world stopped, and he looked me right in the eye, and he said, I'm much better for seeing you today, my friend. I am much better for seeing you. Now, that may not sound like much to you, but that particular day, it saved my life, because I thought, Jimmy's a good guy. I know Jimmy's a good guy. And if he sees something like that in me, maybe I got it wrong. Just maybe. I'll commit suicide tomorrow. It's a day at a time. You know? And I ain't kidding. I'd entertain it again tomorrow, but for today, it's off the table. And he saved my life. So there's a living amend. I've said it to a few here. I'm much better for seeing you because it's true. You've made my life better, allowing me to be here. That's absolutely true. So when we talk about amends and making that list of amends, we'll talk about 9 when we get back from break. There's one way to do it. When we go into a restaurant, I promise you that waiter or waitress, I thank them, and I always tell them what kind of good job they did, and if I remember, I make a point to tell their manager how good a job they did, and I leave a decent tip when I'm paying. And I make them feel guilty if they don't leave a decent tip and I'm not. Now, why wouldn't I do that? Why wouldn't I do that? Getting on the plane the other day, there's a little old lady and this flight attendant who was obviously too busy to do her job told this little old lady, can you walk? Why don't you get up? go down, walk down the plane. And I'm from here to that wall from her. And I see her struggling to get up, and she is a woman of dignity. She's not going to ask anybody. She's going to get up, by God. And she's trying, and she's trying, and she's trying. And I run over, and I say, would you mind if I help? And she grabbed. She said, oh, thank you, you're so sweet. And I said, oh, you're so sweet, thank you. We had a wonderful relationship all the way up here. She'd look back, see if I was in the back there sitting. Because I told her, anything you need now on this trip, you let me know, we'll get it handled. And by our little conversation, she knew she could trust me enough to do that. That's how we make amends today. That's the best way I know, anyway. How about a 15-minute break? Thank you. Hold on. Yeah, my pleasure. So everybody enjoy their break? Good, good, good. Paula, what did I ask you to remind me of? Feigned humility. Yeah. We were talking a little bit, a little off the subject, but on the subject, because we got a lot of AA and Al-Anons here, and real glad for that. And another one of those things I've heard that just annoys me to no end is, I'm a double winner. I came to AA to get sober, and now I went to Al-Anon to get happy. I usually pull them aside and say, what's that supposed to mean? Are there different 12 steps there?
Yeah.
What does that really mean? Other than drawing a little bit of extra attention to you and putting down a program and inferring that you can't find happiness in it, what does that mean? And they usually don't say that anymore. Because one of the things I love is it's the same 12 steps. And I don't have to be an and a anything. If I'm going to be an and a anything, I got to be an and a everything. You know? Because that's just the way I am. That's just the way I am. The other one I like is, and I haven't heard it here, but I hear it a lot of places. I say, how are you? And they go, oh, much better than I deserve. And I say, oh, so God's still wrong, huh? Ever cross your mind just to say thank you and not making it about you simulating humility? I mean, really, think about it. We pick these things up, we hear these things, and we throw them out there. And we're just saying it because it sounds good. Now, if you really mean it, cool. But I think thank you would do better. I had an old-timer in AA once. She said, how are you, Ed? And I said, I am blessed in every area of my life. And he said, well, you might want to give God some credit. I said, what does blessed mean to you? And he said, oh, okay. we got to do 9, 10, 11, 12. We'll do that. Made a list of all persons we'd harmed, became willing to make amends to them all, except when to do so would injure them or others. Nobody in here is another. Let's clear that up. I had a guy call me, one of the guys I sponsored, said, aren't I an other? And I said, why are you asking that? He said, because if I do this, it might cause harm to me. I said, no, you're not an other. An other is an other. I have to become accountable and willing to make amends for what I did. Period. There's some graphic stories in the book about the guy that embarrassed the business partner, stood up in his church, of course, after checking with his family and that. And he could have ruined his whole reputation. I have a similar story. I'm 30 years sober. I'm pastor of a big church, and they asked me to come do an invocation at a city thing, and the mayor was speaking. And I got up, and right as I put my head down to do the invocation, I see a guy I owe amends to I haven't seen in 30 years. And I'm trying to be sincere, but what I'm thinking is all crap. You know? I do my little invocation. I sat down, the mayor talks, And I walked up and I said, Bill, I don't know if you remember me. He said, hi, Ed, how are you? And I said, Bill, 30-some years ago, I broke into your house and stole a lot of stuff. Now, I knew he knew that because the guy that broke into it with me took all the stuff back and blamed it all on me. But that doesn't matter. I'm not there for his amends. I'm there for my amends. So I said to him, Bill, I did that. What in your eyes can I do to make it right? Because that's the key to 8 and 9. It isn't what I think they deserve. I wouldn't have made an amend. It's what can I do to make it right? And I stood there in front of 3,000 people in front of this guy, and he could have just as easily stood up, and you claim to be a pastor of a church, and you claim to be... Never gave it a thought. I know what my job is, and it's to carry on the conversation. And my job was to make amends. And I said, what can I do to make it right? And he said, Eddie, he said, I've watched you over the years. You're doing a lot of good things. The amends you can make to me is keep doing what you're doing. And we're square. And I said, God bless you. Thank you very much. When the reason I went to make amends to Sherman, one of the five guys who killed my father, was because to not tell him he was forgiven would have been self-serving. And there would have been no healing. See, it's one thing to forgive, but it's important that you let the people know that they're forgiven. And I don't mean in, I forgive you for how rotten you were to me. If you're thinking that way, that isn't what I'm talking about. I'm talking about just simply sincerely saying, you know, I just forgive the ramifications of everything that happened between us. I just forgive that. And when I walked into that cell to see that guy I hadn't seen in 27 and a half years, last time I saw him was when I testified him in prison, and I walked in, and he was a bit taken back by my size when I walked in. He took a few steps back, and I told him, I said, my name's Ed Mutum, and I'm here to tell you that I love you and I forgive you, and I believe God loves you, and I know He forgives you. There's only one thing I ask of you. And he said, what's that? And I said, if there's anything I can ever do to add to your life, allow me to do that. Because you see, I don't only want to forgive him, I want to serve him. I want to serve him because I don't want him ever to own me again. Ever. And when we go with that humility and that faith, nobody owns me. Nobody owns me. And it was one of the greatest experiences I've ever had in my life. There was a little nun there that had been praying for Sherman for 30 years. Every day. Never got to see him except today. She came up with me. And the warden was there, and the state attorney general was there, because this, as I told you, this story went nationwide. They were talking about the guy who killed, forgive the guy who killed his father. But anybody in this room understands why I had to do that. Because we say that protested prayer at the end of meetings where it says, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespassed against us. If you want to hang on to that hate, it means you're not going to be forgiven. And the thing I want most in life was to be forgiven. And today I know I am. You know, for a long time in AA, people used to say, what does AA give you? What does AA give you? And I'd say this and that, but nothing really registered with me. And then one day I realized why it never registered with me is because I'd never had it before I came to AA. AA restored my innocence. I am not guilty anymore. I didn't say I'm not perfect, that I'm perfect. I said I'm not guilty anymore. Because even when I make mistakes, I can go to the God of my understanding and say, well, that was really stupid. Please forgive me. And I leave it right there. And when something wonderful happens that moves me, I go to my Father and I say, please forgive me. Or thank you for all the blessings and thank you for that good thing happening. And I leave it right there. Because I want to be freshly present in life today. And in making amends, one of the reasons I need to make amends is to be free from the inside out. Anybody you resent, anybody you're unwilling to make amends to, owns you and is hurting everybody you love, especially the ones that you hold closest and nearest and dearest to you. That's what's happening. I had a lot of different amends I had to make. I remember when I was with the Globetrotters. Now here's a guy from Davenport, Iowa, a street punk, all of a sudden manager of the Harlem Globetrotters, traveling all over the world. And the president came to me one time and said, "Ed, we're going to run Metal Arc Lemon out of here. And we need your help. And if you do this, you'll have a job with the Harlem Globetrotters the rest of your life. We just need your help in this." And I said, "Okay." I said, "No longer give him any sweets. No longer give him any. The best thing that could happen is he walks off before the tour's ended." And I said, "Okay." In Barcelona, France, the last day of the game, Lemon tore off his jersey and threw it at me and said, "I'll never put on that jersey again." And my heart broke. And I didn't want that job anymore. The next year I came back and Lemon wasn't there. And I just didn't care anymore. I'd do the job. Some things happened that cost me to lose the job, but my spirit wasn't there anymore. And I went home, and for a while I thought, you know, God granted you that wonderful opportunity. Why'd you blow it? How'd you blow it? What went on? And one night about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was pacing the floor trying to figure that out. And I realized what was bothering me was not the job. What was bothering me is I betrayed who had become a good friend to me. And that was Metal Arc. He's an amazing man. And so as we tend to do when we get something on our mind, we do it. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, I call Metal Arc's house. His secretary's there, seems to be working late. And she said to me, "Is this Ed Mutum?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "You got a lot of nerve calling here." And I said, "I understand that. Can you put Lemon on the phone?" And she said, "Yeah." And Lemon said, "Hello." And I said, "Lark, this is Ed Mutum. I'm here to ask for your forgiveness. I don't have any defense for what I did. I betrayed a good friend. And I am so, so sorry for that. And I hope someday you'll forgive me. I have no defense." Anyway, yeah, okay, click. About 3 weeks later, I got a call from Lemon. And he's talking, and it's kind of a weird conversation. I can't quite figure it out. 3-4 weeks after that, I get a call from him again. It's a little longer conversation. And he said, "Ed, you know, I got my new team out here." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm having trouble. Somebody's stealing me blind." And I said, "Oh, man, I'm sorry about that." And he said, "Ed, I need somebody I can really trust to come out here and help save my team. Can you come to work for me?" And I said, "Oh, you bet. You bet." See, it always helps to be forgiving when you've been the receiver of great forgiveness. And he's been my best friend ever since. Best friend ever since. Now, where'd I learn that? I learned that here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that it's never too late to make an amends. And if it's real hard to do it, it probably needs to be done that much more for the healing to take place. And, you know, that was 25 years ago, and I don't think Lemon and I have ever mentioned it since. And he's a prayer partner of mine, and he's a pastor now, too. Well, he was a pastor before I came on. So we pray a lot together, and he supports my ministry, and I certainly support his. But I'm so grateful that you taught me to make that call. You taught me to stand up for what you did wrong and set it right. Because I was a fight-or-flight guy. I'd either fight you until you gave up, or I'd run away and not answer it. You taught me to be present, even when it's difficult, even when it breaks my heart that I see what I have done, and intentions don't count. The actions are what counts. And making that amends was very important to me and is to this day. And I'm one of those that amends come up along the way that I told you about the mayor. Metal Arc, I told you about my daughter. That was an amends. I'm 25 years sober, and I'm up in Wisconsin, that's the other side of Minnesota, and up in Hayward, and my sister lives up there, and I used to go up there 2 or 3 times a year, and I remember it was my 25th AA birthday. I was up there visiting, and we were talking about the day I got committed. And I was in 5-point restraint, looking good, and heavily drugged. And the sheriff's posse was literally taking me to the mental institution. And my brother-in-law and I were talking about that. And I look in the mirror, and my sister's back there, and tears are just streaming down her face. And I said, "Sis, what's wrong, honey?" She said, "Ed, I remember that day." She said, "You don't understand. You were gone." She said, "I lost my little brother that day. It just broke my heart." 25 years of all the inventories, not once did I put down exposing my sister Daisy to horrendous circumstances that she had no need to see. Never did. But I turned around and I said, "Oh, sweetie, I am so sorry." She said, "No, Ed." She said, "I know God's touched your life and you're doing wonderful now. But I'll never forget that day because you were gone. You were just mentally gone." Told you about getting a new sponsor. A lot of people ask me why I changed from Clancy. Well, I just decided every 33 and a half years I'm going to switch sponsors. That's right. I'm serious. If you're new in about 30 more years, I'll be looking. Hang around. And I shared with you last night, Tom, and about making amends. He said, "Why don't you make a list of, relook at your list of amends?" And I'm thinking, you know, I've been around 36 years. I've done all that. I'm pretty good at it. And I didn't say that to him. I thought that and did what he asked to do. An incredible healing in my family in the last 2 years that I've been hoping and working for 35. You see, the greatness of what we're involved in here is it's ever-evolving if we'll allow it to. I don't have to have all the answers in advance. That's why we rely on faith rather than intellect. I don't need to have all the answers in advance. I don't need them lined up all in a row so I know what the outcome's going to be, because usually that never happens. What I need to do is take the action. And my 8th step I went through with my sponsor. I needed an unbiased voice to look at that. And he was very helpful with me. This wasn't one, but it was just as ridiculous. You know, I want to apologize for that guy for breaking his hand on my forehead, you know. He said, no, Ed, he took the first punch. Oh, okay. And so there were some that I didn't even need that I felt guilty and I needed to. And then there were some that I needed to that I didn't even have on the list. But through our talking and through going that, and for the first time in my life, see, 6, 7, 8, and 9 is a scrubbing of the soul. It's the inside cleansing that starts with 4 and 5, and it's the scrubbing of the soul, and that's where you get that sense of being clean from the inside out. That's where you get that sense of, for the first time in my life, there was nothing wrong with me. That's where it starts. That's why they put the promises there, because I'm in a position to see them and feel them and experience them in every way. Step 10, when you're wrong, promptly admit it. I've never had to work that one. Step 11, no. Part of step 10 was that spot inventory. God, I used to think, because I had a terrible memory. Well, that's another thing that's probably not true. I remember I told Clancy once, I said, "Clance, I have a terrible memory. I can't remember names at all." He said, "That's not true, Ed. You just don't give a crap." And I said, "That's not true." He said, "Really?" And I said, "Yeah, really." He said, "If they owed you $100, would you remember their name?" And I went, "Probably." He said, "So we're talking priority here. We're not talking bad memory." He had me. I'm better on names than I've ever been. Still not great, but better. But that spot inventory, I kept thinking, how am I going to remember to do a spot inventory, you know? I was one of those help in the morning, thanks at night, and self-will run riot all day long, but you know, so how am I going to do that? Stop and look and see who's in charge. So I tied it with something that I do quite often. That's when I started saying grace. Seemed to work well. I had to tie it with something I do often. I stopped several times a day to eat. My old friend Jim Beam used to say, for crying out loud, Ed, you pray over a Big Mac. And I'd stop, and all I was doing is saying, who's in charge, me or God? Who's in charge? And if it's me, I quit. I'm fired. I'm done. I want it to be God. And I still do that for the same reason today, except now I like to say grace to be really grateful. One of the things that I remember was in that period of time when Clancy slipped me the $5, I was cleaning houses in Venice, California. I was living in a cheap, bad hotel, a one-room thing, and it was not good on Ocean Boulevard. And if you clean an apartment, you get like $10 if you did a really good job. So I cleaned this apartment and I got $5, so I guess I didn't do a good job. And I went to the supermarket and I got my bologna and I got my milk and I got my loaf of white bread, a quart of milk. And I went into that little room and I had a little napkin I'd put on a crate and make my table. And I'd stop and I said grace, and the most amazing thing happened. It changed my life. I was grateful for exactly what I had. I was so grateful for the bologna, the quart of milk, and the loaf of bread. That was my feast for today, and it was more than enough. More than enough. First time I'd ever experienced enough. And that's why I gave you that writing about the daughter and the mother talking about being enough. I wish you enough. I wish you enough. I'd never known what enough was before, and I did that day. Step 10, when you're wrong, promptly admit it. Guy I sponsor says the best step 10 I can do is put this in gear before I put this in gear. You know, this in gear before I put this in gear. Isn't that great information? He said it's kind of like a preemptive step 10. If I do that, my step 10s are reduced tremendously. Isn't that good stuff? I love that. It's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Step 10 on the top of page 86, it's actually, they say 11, it's kind of which way, but there's a wonderful inventory you can do there at night. 86, 87, and 88 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't care what program, faith, whoever you are, 86, 87, 88 does something you might be interested in. It tells you how to live every second of every moment of every minute of every day. It tells you exactly how to get up. It tells you exactly how to go to bed. It tells you exactly what to do if you get confused in between. I stumbled on that at 18 years sober, being a regular student of the book. Everything I need to know about how to live a spiritual life is right there. And it talks about step 10. And taking that little inventory beforehand. It says when we retire at night, we review our day. And it talks about constructively reviewing our day, not destructively reviewing our day.